I think that she was forced into a kind of bravery that she would not have known she possessed. So when he was imprisoned, he asked her to go and petition Haile Selassie for at least a fair trial. She suddenly found herself travelling to Addis Ababa on her own and required to turn up at the High Court and make a case for him by herself. And she was terrified, but she did it.
That's Ida Edemariam. She tells the story of her Ethiopian grandmother, married at 8 into a feudal society. She experienced nearly a century of social and personal transformation. The book is The Wife's Tale. Then we celebrate apple season with a replay of our 2015 interview with Russell Powell about his book, Apples of New England. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. What's it like to live through nearly a century of transformation from a medieval feudal society to one that's fully part of the modern world, and to do so from the point of view of a woman? That's a story that unfolds in lyric and fascinating detail from the pen of my guest Ida Edemariam in The Wife's Tale. It's about her grandmother Yetta Megnu, married at 8 and mother at 15, born into a socially prominent family in Ethiopia in about 1916. The social convulsions of Ethiopian society led to her husband's imprisonment and death. She also lived through the death of a number of her children and the imprisonment of one of them. How she confronted these challenges changed Yetta Megnu profoundly, echoing the changes in the world around her. She was a woman of great sorrow, but also great joy, beset by fears, yet indomitable. She excelled in the domestic wifely arts, but also became a businesswoman. And she was a great storyteller. The New York Times called The Wife's Tale a sublimely crafted tribute to the author's grandmother. But it's much more, a vivid portrayal of Ethiopian society, customs, food, and history through a century of turmoil and change. Ida Edemariam is of dual Ethiopian and Canadian heritage. She's currently a senior feature writer and editor for The Guardian in the UK. I started out by asking Ida Edemariam what her grandmother was like.
She was kind of the center of the family in a way. She was incredibly charismatic, and she was a kind of center around which the sort of Ethiopian family specifically revolved.
Very much. One really does get the sense of her power. And why did you call this The Wife's Tale rather than maybe talk about her as, you know, with her own name or in her own right in that sense? I mean, it's completely centered on her. But why did you call it The Wife's Tale?
It's a good question. I mean, there are a few. I was looking for some of the resonances. So most immediately to Chaucer's Wife of Bath, a little bit to Atwood, I guess. I also wanted to say, look, this is her story and not the man's story. And she was still a child when she was married, so she was a wife for, you know, or a widow for, I don't know, 8 decades. And I guess it's sort of about how you define yourself in and beyond that role. I also wanted to make a very clear point about the point of view, that it was hers and that it was her speaking and it was from her voice, and that was, you know, an incredibly important thing to remember.
And, you know, I'm not even sure what her name is.
Her name is Yetta Megnu Mokonnen, but we all called her Nanny. It's like, you know, I guess it's kind of like granny, but it has an endearment attached to it.
Now, she's a remarkable person, but first before we talk more about her, I'd like you to talk about the society that she was born into in Ethiopia. Almost seemed medieval in the way you describe it, not medieval as a pejorative, but more as a sense of, almost in a magical storybook way.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think, I mean, my sort of, you know, I mentioned Chaucer's The Wife of Bath. There's a lot, but, you know, the way in which religion, for example, is absolutely part of the warp and weft of the medieval world, you know, that is true of Ethiopia still. It's kind of, you know, the language contains Christianity in it, and your sort of relationship to the church is absolutely a daily felt thing. One of the reasons why the book is structured as it is because, you know, the books of hours, the festivals of Mary, literally structure your life. You know, what is it today? Well, today is the day of the sort of, you know, the presentation of Mary to the temple. Well, that is what, this is how our day is structured. You know, Ethiopians fast, well, twice a week, Wednesday and Friday, and then there's long fasts, there's various short fasts, and that world is very, very vivid way. I mean, actually, in fact, the sort of, you know, the Bibles that are used and the Bibles that are referenced in the churches, the old language of Gurs, which is used in much the same way that Latin was in the sort of medieval church. I mean, that, all of that is utterly recognizable in both cultures.
Mm. And tell us, how did Christianity come to Ethiopia? It came quite a long time ago.
Yes, no, very, very early. The thing we're all sort of taught in school, or the thing that you grow up with, is that these brothers, Frumentius and, I need to remember what the other one was called, washed up on sea. They were brothers from Tyre, and they washed up on the Ethiopian coast, the Abyssinian coast, and converted Azana, the emperor. So that's one story, and I think that's like the 4th century AD. It's very, very early. There are arguments, I believe, for even earlier, you know, even earlier development of Christianity in Ethiopia. And it's so old, in fact, that it still holds with it a lot of the Judaic traditions that were in the old church. So, you know, a lot of the food rules are the sort of Judaic food rules. Circumcision is practiced, you know, sort of male circumcision, you know, all that. The Second Temple of Solomon, or whatever, it was very close when Ethiopian Christianity began to develop.
Right, and that would make it... just about as old as Christianity is in Europe.
Older, in some, I mean, older definitely than in Britain.
Yeah, definitely, exactly.
Older.
Because wasn't Constantine in the 4th century? I believe so.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think so.
I have to look it up.
Oh, well, don't bother.
but yes, very old.
Oh, yeah. And Judaism also. I mean, I'm Jewish, so I grew up just knowing about Ethiopian Jews. So
yes.
What is the kind of the interrelationship between these two Abrahamic religions in Ethiopia, you know, kind of back in those days?
Which days are you talking about?
When your grandmother was born.
I mean, there is the extremely old. I mean, because the other founding myth for the, you know, the Ethiopian royalty is the Queen of Sheba came to see King Solomon, and that Arthur, you know, the first king of the Solomonic dynasty, was the son that they had, Menelik, and that is the kind of founding myth that all of it goes back to. So, well, there's that. But in her time, there was a sort of very sizable community of Jews who lived in the rural parts of Begemdium, and, you know, they were the artisans, the craftsmen, blacksmiths. The dominant religion was Christianity. There were issues about land ownership, because you had to be Christian to own land, largely. But they, you know, they had a very, very strong rural community, and they, you know, worked. That was, you know, a lot of the stuff that they did, and people, you know, and as I said, there's a lot of traces of, you know, Judaic practices in the Christianity that's still practiced in Ethiopia, because it was so early.
Right. And also I was impressed by the kind of rituals that you describe in this wonderful book, Idem Edemarium, in The Wife's Tale. The role of dancing and singing and something you call kine. I'm sure I'm
kine,
not pronouncing
yeah.
it. Oh, I am pronouncing
That's
it
all
correctly.
Right.
Okay. So talk about, I mean, it's a very different kind of Christianity, and yet one that seems familiar in some very atavistic sense.
Yes, I mean, Kene is religious poetry. Amharic is an incredibly rich and complex language. Kene is kind of the apogee of it, in that education was at that time all through the church. You know, if you were educated in the church, you learned all the books of the Old Testament, the New Testament, you learned the Psalm. And Kene was a distillation. The other thing about Kene is it uses, I mean, quite often there will be literally four, you know, at least two, three, four puns simultaneously in the same sort of, you know, they might be two lines long, but you could, the ways in which you use that language, you could be saying like at least three different, completely different things, you know, a very specific religious commentary or a political commentary, or, you know, they were literarily incredibly complex. The other thing I was very interested to find was, I don't know if you know the work of Marina Warner, and specifically her book about Mary, Alone of All Her Sex, which is about the dominance and the sort of quite complex veneration of Mary in the Catholic Church. That is very much echoed in the Ethiopian Church. You know, Mary only, you know, turns up two or three times, very tiny amount of times in the actual Bible. But, you know, she's an intercessor. There's a sort of her entire sense of the miracles of Mary, the life cycle of Mary. She's very much the figure that women turn to, and my grandmother very much did. The figure of Mary was the thing that you looked up to and attempted to be, although obviously you were always already failing. There was no way you could do that. So she's a very interesting figure in terms of giving comfort and succor and allowing a kind of access to the divine while at the same time keeping women in a subjugated place.
It's so interesting because in a way you can say that's very much a position of women even in our world. You know, impossible standards are being set for women all the time, whether they be standards of beauty or, you know, being able to do it all.
So you have to be pure, you have to be a mother. You have to kind of be utterly, you know, good. You also have to be, it's just amazing. You know, yeah, it's very similar. I hadn't thought of it that way. It's very true.
And Mary is even encoded in your name, Adamariam, also the name of, was that your father then?
Yeah.
Yes.
Adamariam is Hand of Mary. Yeah.
Hand of Mary, exactly. So now your grandmother became a wife at age 10. Talk about that marriage. Why was she married off so young, and who was she married to, and why? That's a lot.
Right, all of them at once. Well, I don't think. She was very young, but it wasn't as unusual as you might think. I mean, this is true actually across cultures in some ways, where, you know, a marriage is about the union of families, and the children are sometimes kind of incidental, but, you know. So she was. It was an agreement where she was married to this priest who was about 20 years older than she was. You know, he was a rising star, as it were, in the church. But in order to sort of, you had to be, you know, priests needed to be married in order to cement their position as priests. She was very well born. She had, and that was very good for his social standing, because, you know, particularly because he came from a neighboring province, Gojam, which might as well have been, you know, another country as far as the Gondares are concerned. Mm-hmm. he was a brilliant scholar. He was very good at Kene. He was, even though he was cursed by his father as a child and told not to write because he was caught working on magic scrolls, and his father, who was also a priest, well, you know, you're sort of calling out the devil. There is no way you can ever write again. So he actually had to do everything by heart. He had to do his poetry by heart. He had to, you know, learn whatever, you know, 13, 14 years of, you know, actually probably more of religious study, all of it from memory. And yeah, he was sort of socially unknown, I guess, but he very quickly made a name for himself.
Now, he's a complicated person, because on the one hand, it was clear he loved your grandmother very, very much, but he could also be exceedingly brutal. Talk about their relationship and how it evolved over the course of their marriage.
She was a child, and it is complicated. He's a complicated figure. She was a child when they were married, and he was put in a kind of weird husband-parent role. So, you know, it's only quite recently, you know, even here that, you know, people, you know, corporal punishment was part of the kind of armory of, you know, parents. Mm-hmm. Not quite recent. I mean, when I say quite recently, maybe it's sort of been at the beginning of, you know, first half of the century or maybe later. And that was, you know, so he, you know, basically he was doing, he was trying to sort of raise her right. he was also quite jealous. He was jealous, and he knew she was beautiful, and he knew that she was much younger than, you know, and so he kept her at home. And I mean, what she said about him, you know, and she came to love him. She didn't initially at all, but she came to love him, I think. I mean, what she said to him about him to me was, you know, he was a very good man with a great flaw, which was his temper.
Right. And she spent, I mean, the early years, she closed herself off quite a bit from him. You know, she wouldn't speak to him, except, I suppose, what would be necessary. She had children by him, but, you know, at least in the early years, that was quite difficult for her. Her first child was when she was 12, is that right?
15. Probably
oh,
15.
It was 15, okay. But she really becomes stronger, much, much stronger as time goes on, and he has to recognize that. What really came to me about your grandmother is that, as you said in the beginning, she's charismatic, she's powerful, a powerful woman in a powerless position. Talk about how she negotiated that and how that developed in her. I know that might be a lot to chew, a lot to bite off and chew, but, you know, just from your heart, how do you see that she developed in that way?
I think she wouldn't necessarily have seen herself as strong. I think she often saw herself as afraid, but I think it's a complicated dance, isn't it? Between, I mean, within the home, the woman is in charge, while at the same time not being expected to sit and eat with the men and to serve. I think that she was forced into a kind of bravery that she would not have known she possessed. So when he was imprisoned and he asked her to go and petition Haile Selassie for at least a fair trial and eventually his release, she suddenly found herself, you know, having been at home, jealously guarded, traveling to Addis Ababa on her own and required to turn up at the High Court and make a case for him by herself. And she was terrified, but she did it. One of the things I really attempted to do in this book was to listen, because every time I, you know, might be tempted to sort of put something very much in my own words, I would go back to her and I was just like, my gosh, you have this extraordinary way of putting things. And so there's quite a lot of the book which is just directly translated from what she said to me. And she had, you know, she was very bright. She was not allowed an education, but she was incredibly bright, incredibly quick, very, what's the word? She was incredibly collected. She was incredibly emotionally open and had an extraordinary access to her feelings in a way that often I think you see children do and, you know, adults grow out of, which I think to their detriment, obviously, often. But at the same time, she had a huge dignity and a huge kind of authority. And, you know, she spent a good chunk of her life a widow. And I think at some level, she recognized fairly quickly. First, she tried to be a nun, and then she wasn't allowed to do that. I think she realized that, you know, that this was a sort of a kind of powerful position where you had land and you had your children, but you were not subject to anybody. And she, you know, she grew into it.
Mm-hmm. And yet at a certain point, she began to have fits. You call it czar. I'm not sure what that is. What was that about?
I think that's very interesting, that whole strand. I think that it's a sort of kind of spirit possession. It exists. Ethiopia is a very, very old Christian country, well, half Christian, half Muslim, and partly Jewish, although actually many obviously have now gone to Israel. But previous to that, there were animist traditions, and they coexist in some ways alongside the Christianity. I think it's a completely fascinating phenomenon because, as we discussed with the sort of the veneration of Mary, but also the sort of very patriarchal, very controlled setup of the Orthodox Church, there isn't a lot of space for women to express themselves. And these czar ceremonies, and they were very female, although men were involved sometimes. There are sort of arguments to say that they were kind of a group therapy, or they were kind of where you could, there was a freedom to express fears, or it was a great relief for her and a sort of emotional outlet. It was also a kind of, you know, another source of power because, you know, her husband, as many sort of, you know, Orthodox Christian men or whatever, you know, they would be required to accede to requests made by the Tsar or made through the sort of her as a sort of medium for the Tsar. So they kind of fear, they didn't approve of it necessarily, but they feared it and respected it. So it is a very interesting channel for a different kind of power.
So you begin the book, The Wife's Tale, Ida and Mariam, with talking about her tears, you know, and there was certainly a lot of tragedy in her life, and you've just spoken about how close she was to her feelings. I wonder if you could talk more about her tears and, you know, do you feel that that's what dominated? Because in a way, it doesn't really feel to me that it is what dominated her life. And yet I defer to you, who knew her better.
She would say they dominated. She cried a lot, but she also laughed a lot. You know, I would ask her about her mother, and immediately she would be crying. But she could also, you know, she'd tell an amazing story or, you know, I mean, she suffered a great deal. And there's a weird thing where you know somebody all your life and so you don't really think about it like that. You just think, well, that's what happened to Nanny. And then you sort of, I remember attempting to describe miscarriage. And I was just like, oh my God, this is actually really hard to describe because it was really upsetting. And I don't know, you have to, I guess she sort of survived it. And she did, there was a lot of grief. And I think eventually the grief overwhelmed when she was very, very old, when she sort of outlived five of her children.
Mm-hmm. You also, I just have to give a little bit of space to the beautiful language that you employ in this book and your descriptions of Ethiopia, of the food. Of course, she was a cook par excellence, mm-hmm. is the sense that I got, and that, you know, as a woman of means, there were a lot of tasks she didn't have to do, but she did have to do cooking. So talk about the role of cooking and her as a cook, not in the family so much, but in her community, her social role and how that was expressed through cooking.
Well, as you say, she had to do a lot of it, and particularly when my grandfather was building his church. I mean, you never knew, because he was so, you know, in the end, he ran 44 churches, and every lunchtime he'd attempt to come home, and she had no idea how many people were going to come home, and she had to have enough food ready for everybody. But she was a very, very good cook, and the fact is that, you know, it's incredibly time-consuming. You're doing everything from scratch, you know. If you make bread, you're starting from the kernel, and you're the same with every single spice. It is also, it's a very rich cuisine with very strict rules, and how well you do it is a kind of measure, how well and how plentiful it is a kind of measure of your standing. So it is a kind of silent claim for social achievement. And it also, you know, it was a place where she suddenly realized that, you know, she was good at being in charge, you know, and, you know, it takes years to get to this point, but she got there, and she was at my grandfather's zenith and hers. They run this party every year, which was the feast of the presentation of Mary to the temple. And it would go on for 2 weeks. They would feed people for 2 weeks. You know, you'd start with the absolute dignitaries, the kind of, you know, royalty, gentry, the monks and the priests from the church, and anybody could turn up. And she will have made the mead. She would have made the barley beer. It was fasting season when Ethiopians don't eat meat or eggs or anything like that. So there was a lot of inventiveness involved in making this sort of party tasty. And every year she sort of pulled this off, and it was a kind of major thing. I mean, people still talk about it, you know, in Gondo, the older generation. You know, it's a rural, it is a predominantly rural country. So food and the fruit of the land and the quality of it is incredibly important. It's an agrarian, you know, agrarian is the right word, isn't it? It's an agrarian economy. It's kind of, you know, it's changed a bit now, but, you know, it was like that was absolutely what was important.
Now, you grew up in Addis Ababa, and now you live in London.
In Oxford, Oxford, London, yeah, sorry.
Right. Well, you've certainly traversed a huge territory, not just in miles, but in, you know, in culture. Even more so for her, I wonder if you could just reflect for a moment on the changes, the difference between the Ethiopia of her birth and now, at a time when, you know, Ethiopia has just really been, I have to say, has been through the ringer, you know, for decades, you know, with the dictatorship and now, you know, now there's finally peace with Eritrea, but still, mm-hmm. Terrible, terrible suffering, and not to speak of the Italian occupation, which you talk about quite a bit in the early part of the book, and was, you know, shocking to me. I mean, no colonial.
I think Italian. I think it was a lot more shocking than people have ever really known. There's a man called Ian Campbell who's kind of made a life's work of going into the atrocities that the Italians, the fascists, inflicted on Ethiopia, and for some reason, because it was sort of actually, you know, arguably, I'm not sure if this is sort of, you know, arguably the Second World War started in 1937 in Ethiopia with the fascist invasion, you know, and the fascists were very brutal indeed. Yeah, I mean, that was one of the attractions of telling the story the way I did, which was she was born into what was a sort of loose collection of feudal kingdoms with an emperor. But it was quite loose, you know. There were sort of kings that ran their own sort of fiefdoms. They kind of, you know, they kind of had loyalty to the center up to a point, and then if they didn't like things, they would kind of, you know, they often had armies that were as big or bigger as the emperor's. And the coronation of Haile Selassie in 1930, as you say, the Italian invasion in 1935, and he disappeared into exile. And then when he returned, he centralized the empire. He was very, very assiduous about, because before taxes were paid to the local lords, for instance, but he drew it all to the middle, and he had a very absolute control. And at his height, it was a kind of, you know, a very centrally controlled, extraordinary sort of, you know, a strong empire. Yeah, he held on too long. And then there was a revolution in 1974, which was followed by, you know, a Marxist dictatorship. Basically, in, you know, she lived for nearly 100 years, and she saw the transition between an Ethiopia that had, you know, in the words of the historian, sort of Edward Illendorf, had been the same for 1,600 years, mm-hmm. and had passed through what claimed to be a democracy. I don't agree that it was, but it claimed to be a democracy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is a vast, I mean, you know, that's usually generations and generations, but she saw it in one lifetime. The distance between her, you know, what she remembered, you know, she was born in about, I mean, like, it's very, there was no way I could actually pin down exactly what year, because people don't write these things down. They might remember exactly what saint's day they were born in, but have no idea what year. Mm-hmm. About 1916, I guess. And me, I mean, I'm half Canadian, so my mother is Canadian. So I always had a kind of Western, I also always had the Western culture running alongside the Ethiopian culture. But, you know, I left when I was 15, and I've you know, studied in Britain. I've lived in Britain and America and Canada. And the distance between her childhood and where I am now is so vast. but I was trying my best to, if you listen hard enough, you can hear, I think, all the things that matter to us all.
Absolutely. It is just a magical tale and a very moving one. Ida Edemariam, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you very much.
Ida Edemariam. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Wife's Tale. Next up, we celebrate apple season with Russell Powell. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Back in 2015, we interviewed apple maven Russell Powell about his book, Apples of New England, A User's Guide. Well, it's apple season right now, so we thought we'd do a public service and air that interview again. Before the apples of Washington State, there were the apples of New England. Johnny Appleseed himself came from Leominster, Massachusetts, and before him, in fact, almost as soon as the Puritans had touched ground at Plymouth Rock, apple trees were brought to the region from England. My guest, Russell Stephen Powell, is the perfect person to write the story of the New England apple. A writer, visual artist, and a magazine publisher, he's devoted his talents to bringing the unique sense of place of the New England landscape to a larger audience. He was a publisher and editor of New England Watershed, a journal of culture, art, and ideas, and he's executive director of the New England Apple Association. He's written two books on the subject, America's Apple, and his newest, a regional history and guidebook, Apples of New England, out from the Countryman Press. Well, Russell Powell, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
This is just a lovely book, Apples of New England, A User's Guide. Why did you write this book?
Well, I feel that apples have a special hold on our imaginations as well as our stomachs. And we have such a rich tradition of growing apples in New England with so many varieties that were discovered here centuries ago but are now forgotten or nearly forgotten. I felt that it was time to bring this history to light.
And in fact, the apple came very early to New England. Talk about the first New England apples and how they arrived here.
It's really astonishing to me as I look back that the first record of apples in New England dates back to 1623, only 3 years after the Mayflower. And I think that points to the importance of apples, not just as a food, but as a symbol of the landscape from which the Europeans came. In England, everybody had their few small apple trees, and I think they really wanted to replicate that model when they came to the New World. And part of that is obviously about food, that at the time, apples were a major source of year-round sweetness, could be distilled into vinegar, could be pressed into cider and fermented into hard cider, and that was available as a drink year-round. So really, 1623 is the beginning, and it was through bringing apple seeds rather than scions to be grafted. We did not have apples here in New England. We had a few native crab apples, and the seeds were going to produce fruit that was not necessarily edible, but at the time that was not really important. What was important was that you could press any apple, no matter how sour or bitter, into juice, and it would be magically transformed into something sweet and tasty.
So tell us about the Reverend William Blackstone.
He was an odd duck, for sure. He definitely did a lot to promote the apple in the New World and planted an orchard in Boston soon after his arrival in the 1620s. And from there, he went to Rhode Island. He is credited by some for the first named variety in the U.S., called, William Sweeting, or Blackstone Sweeting, I'm sorry. And most people now feel that Roxbury Russet from 1635 is the true first named variety. But Blackson was a character, and he was described as sometimes riding through town on the back of a bull, and he would either toss flowers to passersby or apples, depending on the season.
Now, another very famous person in apple history, someone I didn't know came from New England, came from Massachusetts, was Johnny Appleseed, John Chapman. Tell us about him.
Chapman, I think, was a very amazing man who has not gotten the credit that he deserves through history. Many of the stories about Chapman are fictionalized accounts of his life, beginning with the tin mushpot hat, which many depict him wearing, for which there's no historical evidence. He was America's first great walker. He was born in Leominster, Massachusetts, in the eastern part of the state. And when he was six, his father remarried a woman from Longmeadow, Massachusetts. And that's where he grew up, near the Connecticut River. And when he was 23, he set out on foot for Pennsylvania. There's still no historical record at this point that he had anything to do with apples. We assume that maybe he had some experience with this fruit, but there's no evidence to support that. And he spent the better part of the next decade in Pennsylvania, living in the wilderness, and presumably this is where he gained his horticultural skills. And in the early 1800s, around 1806, he is setting out west. He collected seeds from cider mills in western Pennsylvania and took them west to Ohio initially, and later on in his life, Indiana. Those are the only two states where he is known to have planted orchards, although some 30 states claim that he planted orchards there. And he would set out mostly on foot, sometimes on horseback, occasionally by canoe, with his bags of seeds. And he would try to anticipate where the European settlers were migrating westward. And often this was near either a previous Indian settlement or near a body of water, a river confluence. And he would clear about 3 acres of land and use the brush to create a fence around it. And he would plant his seeds, and then he would periodically return to this area and tend the young saplings. And when they were a reasonable height and the settlers had arrived, he had a ready-made market for them, in part because of the apple's versatility and in part because, in many cases, land-grant companies required settlers to purchase apple trees as a good faith indicator that they were sincere about staying on the land and were not speculators. So he would sell the saplings for a few cents apiece and then move on to the next settlement. He wasn't the only person doing this, but he was far and away the most energetic, and he did it for about 40 years. And his real contribution to the spreading of the apple gene is that he accelerated the process of natural selection, because he would only choose the best seedlings. He was dealing in a climate and geography that was new to the apple, and by choosing only the best saplings, he really allowed the apple to progress westward at a much more rapid rate than it would have otherwise.
So you go even into his philosophy. He's a very interesting person from that point of view. You link him to Henry David Thoreau, although it doesn't seem that they ever met. I wonder if you could talk about his sensibilities, you know, his philosophy.
Yes, he was a Swedenborgian, Emanuel Swedenborg, the philosopher who developed, and theologian, who developed a whole cosmology of the universe. And his most famous follower was Ralph Waldo Emerson. And Thoreau, like Emerson, was a transcendentalist and very much had similar views that basically everything in nature is divine. And it's not just the people and the animals and the flowers, but it's also the rocks and the soil and so on. And the Swedenborg philosophy, it's pretty complicated. It's pretty sophisticated. And here was John Chapman out on the edge of civilization Western civilization promoting this. And it really made him kind of a marvel. He was physically unkempt. He was, in some respects, very Christ-like. He eschewed material comforts, and he wore very little clothing, and he stayed out in the wilderness. So he would show up occasionally in town at someone's house looking kind of like this wild man, but preaching this very sophisticated religion that came from Swedenborg. So he was kind of he created some ambivalence among his audience. And because he left no written record, we have to really speculate on how Chapman felt about apples. We assume because of his nickname, because of the years that he spent planting orchards, that he was passionate about this fruit, but we have no record of it. And even the stories about him have very little to do with apples. Thoreau, on the other hand, was very passionate about apples and wrote a very beautiful essay called Wild Apples. And he also writes about apples in his book Cape Cod, about his three walks on the length of the Cape. And what I suggest in this book is that Thoreau, in effect, gives language to what we believe Chapman felt based on Chapman's lifestyle. But we don't have Chapman's record for it. So, you know, it's kind of the effete Easterner Thoreau who gives voice to this guy in the wilderness.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Russell Stephen Powell about his beautiful book. It's called Apples of New England, A User's Guide. So talk a little bit about the history of New England apple orchards, you know, the kind of crop that they were to begin with, and then how they became commercialized.
Well, for the first century, from the 1600s into well into the 1700s, the apples were pretty much part of a typical small farm where people would have a few chickens, they'd grow their fruits and vegetables, and they'd have a little row of apple trees. And every household would make apple butter and apple sauce and cider. Cider was really the nation's main drink until about the 1850s. It was really only gradually in the 1800s that we began to see more and more grafted varieties coming over from Europe and created here in the States. And at that time, we began to see larger and larger orchards being planted, and there began to be an export market for apples. And we would ship apples in barrels from Maine and Boston to England in particular, but also the West Indies and other places. So there was a substantial market for our apples, and we also shipped them domestically to other parts of the Midwest and Northeast. But apples generally at that time were still part of a diversified farm. And it was only in the late 1800s and into the 1900s that farmers began to really specialize in just growing apples. And with the advent of refrigeration around the 1900s and the demise of the hard cider industry from pressure resulting from the temperance movement, the apple industry really had to reinvent itself and present apples as now primarily for fresh eating. And because of refrigeration, they could grow fewer varieties instead of having early ones that could be available as early as late July, but didn't keep very well, and some that would be very hard throughout the winter or could be picked late into the fall. Growers gradually were able to concentrate on fewer varieties that could be picked over a much shorter season. And the emphasis was no longer on strictly cider, but on fresh eating apples. And it was in 1904 that a man named John Stinson came up with the phrase, an apple a day will keep the doctor away. And that kind of signaled this big change in apple growing. At the time, New England was still a major player nationally. This was well before Washington State began producing much in the way of apples. So we were still a big supplier. And the big varieties around 1900 were all New England apples. Baldwin, which came from 1740 in Wilmington, Massachusetts. Rhode Island Greening, an even older apple from the 1600s, originating in Rhode Island. And Northern Spy, which the seeds for the Northern Spy came from an orchard in Salisbury, Connecticut. So we really were major players at the time, and that gradually shifted over the course of the 20th century as Washington gained prominence and was able to take advantage of much bigger spaces for growing apples and a better climate in many respects. And New England had to face some significant weather pressures. That's always an issue. It still is. For example, the Baldwin apple was almost wiped out in the winter of 1933-34 from a major freeze, and it has never fully recovered from that. So now we have varieties like McIntosh and Cortland and McCown and Empire that do very well in our soils and have been part of our landscape for a century or more in the cases of Cortland and McIntosh, and we're still, volume-wise, a small player nationally, but certainly within our region, apples continue to have a very large presence in our communities.
And it does seem that some varieties are coming back. I mean, I've been at the Brattleboro Food Co-op, and they have a broad range of varieties, many of which I've never heard of.
Well, what we are discovering over the past, say, 20 years, is that a lot of these, what we consider to be heirloom apples, have very good qualities, but they may have one flaw that prevents them from being a mass-produced apple across the nation. They may grow well only in New England soils, or even a portion of New England. They may be a great-tasting apple, but they don't grow to a very large size. Some apples have a russeted skin that's kind of copper-colored with an almost light sandpapery feel. And marketers believe that consumers want strictly the bright red, the bright green, or the bright yellow apple. But some of these russeted apples, like Roxbury Russet, are delicious. They're some of the most flavorful apples out there. So I think what we're seeing is people realizing that there's a whole range of flavors and textures and colors available if they are willing to explore a little bit further. And with this, I think orchards have responded, and even our larger commercial orchards are now replanting some of these heirloom varieties. So while some of them may still be hard to find, if you're willing to search a little bit, you can find a lot of these. I think in addition to their food value, people are really fascinated by their unusual histories, and that was another reason that I chose to write the book. It's hard to think now that an apple could have been discovered in an urban community like Dedham, Massachusetts, but the Benoni apple was very popular for decades. And then we have unusual names like the Westfield Seat No Further from Westfield, Massachusetts. And I think that either the names or the stories or the locales for some of these apples really add substantially to their appeal. And you feel like you're taking a bite not just out of a piece of fruit, but out of a piece of our history.
There have been and continue to be some challenges to growing apples in New England and elsewhere. I remember the big Alar scare of 1989. And there was another E. coli scare in 1996, but let's take the Alar scare first.
Yeah, that was a major problem for the apple industry. Alar was identified as a possible cancer-causing agent. It was in the process of being eliminated from orchards, but in hindsight, I think that the industry responded too slowly. And as a result, there was a lot of publicity, negative publicity, led by Meryl Streep. And she appeared on a number of national television shows, beginning with 60 Minutes. She testified before Congress. And it really put a lot of growers out of business. The market for Red Delicious in particular just dropped in half in a period of about 6 months. And there's still a lot of, I think, residual resentment about this from the region's growers. since they were on the verge of phasing this out in the first place. But as I say, I think they have to take some responsibility for moving too slowly to make that happen. We are challenged in all parts of the country and in all parts of the agriculture with orchard pests and agricultural pests. And the problem is exacerbated in our current time as an unintended byproduct of global trade. It's almost impossible for us to inspect all of these big container ships that come in from all over the world. And we're seeing new bugs that we've never heard of before. And they are creating havoc, not just with apples, but with all kinds of fruits and vegetables. And it does pose a challenge. And the way growers have responded in the region is to use something called integrated pest management, which is a series of controls that are designed to improve the ecology of the orchard by strengthening the trees through nutrition and dealing with pests in some non-chemical ways with the introduction of beneficial pests to eat the bad ones, the use of pheromones to trap or confuse the pests, and sophisticated weather monitoring and targeting of just particular blocks of the orchard that are affected rather than the whole orchard, and really setting economic thresholds that have to be met before any treatment is done. That there's no longer this idea that you can eliminate a certain pest, but what you try and do is keep its numbers beneath a certain level so that whatever economic damage results is not going to put the grower out of business.
We're talking with Russell Stephen Powell about his history and guidebook, Apples of New England. Yeah, and then there was also the E. coli scare of 1996 had a huge impact on apple, on small apple growers. Connect the dots for us between that scare, which happened when there was contaminated juice from Odwalla, and that was out in California, and it may or may not have even been the apple juice, but it resulted in a big change in regulations.
It was very unfortunate for New England's cider producers because, as you say, the incident happened out on the West Coast, and it was about apple juice. It had nothing to do with New England growers or cider, but it was a serious incident. The Odwalla Juice Company took responsibility. It was around conditions at their plant, and they made changes, and they paid fines, and, you know, they did try and take responsibility. But it made people seriously concerned about the safety of the juice they were drinking. And what eventually came about was a series of regulations, including the fact that fresh cider now had to be pasteurized. And this was a very expensive proposition for a small producer, and it put a lot of the small growers out of the cider business here in New England. And to this day, there's still a lot of controversy around this. Some of the smaller cider pressers are still in business and are using some of these unusual heirloom varieties to make very interesting blends, but there are regulations about how they label that. It can only be sold on the farm. It can't be sold in the supermarket. So it really destroyed the market for cider fruit and limited the major producers to fewer varieties and the requirement that they pasteurize the cider.
And yet there does seem to be a kind of renaissance in apple ciders, hard ciders. Do these regulations apply to hard ciders? Because, I mean, isn't alcohol, you know, kind of antibiotic?
Once you ferment the cider into hard cider, you no longer have that concern that you would have with fresh cider. And you are seeing some tremendous growth and variety in the hard cider market. You're seeing it at the high end with companies like Sam Adams coming out with their Angry Orchard or Harpoon Brewery in Boston and Vermont, or Woodchuck Cider that bottle six packs of cider, hard cider. These tend to be on the sweet side, and they're very different from some of the blends. You have very small producers creating all over New England, and many people even just in their homes. It's relatively easy to make hard cider, and there are some astonishingly interesting blends now, some of them very dry, some of them a little sweeter. with this capacity to mix and match unusual varieties in a way that the big producers just can't do because they just don't have the volume.
Well, Russell Powell, before we go, I'd like to ask you, what's your favorite eating apple?
I get that question asked a lot, and I have to whittle it down to a few. I can't narrow it down to one. But when it comes to fresh eating apples, I have long been a fan of Macaun, which is a cross between Macintosh and an old heirloom called Jersey Black. And Jersey Black gives Macaun its distinctive wine red color and kind of a boxy shape. But it's got a very nice, crisp, sweet tart flavor. It's maybe a little more complex or spicy than Macintosh, but it's really a distinctive apple. I do love Macintosh, by the way. I love them both fresh, and I love them to cook with. Among the newer apples, my favorite would be Jonagold, which is an apple from 1968 developed in New York State. And it has for its parents the Golden Delicious and an old heirloom called Jonathan, which has a deep red color. So Jonagold has this light, explosive crispiness. It's very juicy, and it's sweeter than Macaun, but has a little bit of that tartness. And the other one I would mention is an heirloom called Cox's Orange Pippin, which is still very popular in England, where it was developed in 1825. It's a gorgeous apple with nice red and orange striping, and it has very complex flavor. It's got hints of half a dozen different spices and flavors, and it's really an extraordinary apple. So I'll stop at those three, but I could certainly add more to the list.
Well, that's a great list, and I have to say Macaun is one of my very favorites as well. I want to thank you so much, Russell Stephen Powell, for coming out with this book, Apples of New England, A User's Guide, and for talking with us here.
Well, thank you. And eat more apples.
I want to ask you, is it true that an apple a day will keep the doctor away?
Well, they are very healthy. They're high in a number of vitamins. They have a lot of pectin. They have a number of antioxidants. So a number of studies have related them to having a beneficial effect in reducing cancer, several kinds of cancer rates. And they're fat-free, low-cal. They're even a great way to there's an apple diet where if you want to lose weight, if you have an apple before your meal, you're going to eat less at that meal. And certainly if you're in the mood for something sweet, an apple is a far better choice than most of the empty calorie, sugar-filled snack foods that many people choose as an alternative.
Well, hear, hear to that. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Francesca. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Russell Stephen Powell. You can find links to his blogs, including those about his art and those about apples, by going to writersvoice.net.
And that was our 2015 interview with Russell Stephen Powell about his book, The Apples of New England. And here's the poem by Robert Frost, After Apple Picking. My long two-pointed ladder's sticking through a tree toward heaven still, and there's a barrel that I didn't fill beside it, and there may be two or three apples I didn't pick upon some bough. But I'm done with apple-picking now. Essence of winter sleep is on the night. The scent of apples I am drowsing off. I cannot rub the strangeness from my sight I got from looking through a pane of glass I skimmed this morning from the drinking trough and held against the world of hoary grass. It melted, and I let it fall and break. But I was well upon my way to sleep before it fell, and I could tell what form my dreaming was about to take. Magnified apples appear and disappear, stem end and blossom end, and every fleck of russet showing clear. My instep arch not only keeps the ache, it keeps the pressure of a ladder round. I feel the ladder sway as the boughs bend, and I keep hearing from the cellar bin the rumbling sound of load on load of apples coming in. for I have had too much of apple picking. I am overtired of the great harvest I myself desired. There were 10,000 fruit to touch, cherish in hand, lift down, and not let fall. For all that struck the earth, no matter if not bruised or spiked with stubble, went surely to the cider apple heap as of no worth. One can see what will trouble this sleep of mine, whatever sleep it is. Were he not gone, the woodchuck could say whether it's like his long sleep, as I describe its coming on, or just some human sleep. Thanks to the Poetry Foundation for that poem by Robert Frost, After Apple Picking. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.